Hello, critics and theorists. Welcome back to Critique of the Podcast Form. This is episode 8 on the anime question. I am J.E. Morin. I'm from the editorial board of CTWG, regular host here on Critique of the Podcast Form. I am joined today by Anatara.
Hello.
Hey, guys.
Ray. And then I'm also joined by Cam and Hannah.
Hello.
Say hello.
Hi.
So the main focus of our discussion today is we're kind of structuring our discussion around a book by Mark Steinberg, Anime's Media Mix. But before we get into that, I think we're all just going to kind of go sort of round robin real quick and talk about our familiarity with anime, manga, etc. And I'd like to pass it off to Anatara to start this because he has a really funny, interesting anecdote that he told us before.
Oh, okay. All right. So I'm from the MENA region, or if we want to be more decolonially correct, Swana. So I've been watching more or less anime for my whole life, as long as I remember, and I remember like the distinct feature that made it kind of stick into my head. It was like it had like long term narratives, unlike most of the other cartoons that I was watching. And here I'm mainly thinking about Looney Tunes and the various Warner Brother properties, and a lot of the animation that I grew up with watching was dubbed. And it was interesting that anime as a commodity, as we were growing up, was kind of like conformed, like it was configured in such a way that it was bolstering the political projects of the region at the time. So the big three countries that were doing anime dubs were the big countries that were doing the Arab Nationalist Project: Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and then there was the more open GCC countries, the Gulf countries, the Persian Gulf countries, Kuwait, and stuff like this. Kuwait dubbed Future Boy Conan, the Hayao Miyazaki property, and they named it Adnan Walina. And so there was some quasi competition during those programming, like broadcasting days. So Saudi Arabia and the rivaling quasi-Arab nationalist bloc, Spacetoon, which is what most of my generation grew up on, they both dubbed Detective Conan. And so the Saudi Arabian dub from like this, I forgot what the channel was called, that completely changed Conan's name. They made him Muslim, and so when he saw I forgot what his name is, like this stealth kid or something, and he's like, "You're wasting your youth and your afterlife. How dare you not be a good Muslim?" And then he's like, "My name is like Kamal whatever," and it's like a famous meme, and this, I'm just gonna fucking coin it, and this like Arab otaku adjacent community. And that's kind of how I grew up on the thing. It's just like I saw the cultural adaptation of my global anime. So yeah, that's my brief history and kind of situating how I come to this medium. I've been watching it for my whole life. Regrettably, you know, it doesn't have the best reputation. But I still love my problematic commodity, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I will guess pass it to whoever is next in the round robin.
I'll just go next. I don't have too much to say. Like you, Anatara, I've been watching it for a lot of my life. But like, you know, the stuff that I was watching when I was a kid is like people, you know, it's the kind of stuff that people like, it doesn't really count, like Pokemon, right? Like the dubs Pokemon where they say, "Oh, time to eat this jelly donut." And it's a, you know, it's a rice ball.
Yeah.
That shit. You know, the whole four kids type of shit on American TV.
Yep.
But then I think the big break for me was Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z.
That makes sense.
They started putting Dragon Ball Z, the remastered version, They took out like the filler, and they took out also like all the blood and the very, you know, minor or like mild swearing that it had. So it'd be like, damn and hell. And they took all that out. Because when Dragon Ball Z originally came to the West, it was dubbed by Saban, which is like the company that does Power Rangers, where they like replace all of the Japanese actors with Americans. It's really weird. I remember my family had the complete set of the translated original Dragon Ball manga, so I read all of that. But if you wanted to like follow like Dragon Ball Z beyond the show that was, you know, airing weekly on television, you had to really go out of your way to get like the DVDs. I remember I had to go to go all the way across the city I lived in to a store, really small, kind of not run down, but you know, not particularly upscale kind of, you know, anime store. And I would rent Dragon Ball Z DVDs from there. And this was in like, I don't know, 2012, you know, 2011, 2012, something. So this was not like a million years ago. This was, you know, I was in like whatever grade that is. And it was still like, you couldn't like Dragon Ball Z and stuff was not like, you couldn't, this was not like on streaming or whatever. Like you had to go to the anime store that every city had one. And it was, you know, always, you know, in some random, you know, tucked away in some corner somewhere. You had to go all the way to this place, rent the DVD. They wouldn't let you buy this thing. It was too valuable. You know, you watch that, you go take that home, you watch it a couple of times, whatever, and you have to go bring it back and you go get another one. You know, you give them, what is it, Fusion Reborn, which is the one with Gogeta, and you take a, what's another one? The Tree of Might. It's another Dragon Ball Z movie. So that's kind of where I got into it. And then, you know, later on, you know, I discovered this incredible thing called piracy. You know, you can just steal it. You can just steal it and you can just read manga online for free. You don't have to pay Viz, you know, however much to get the full, you know, volume of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z. You can just read it for free because some guy who has clearly has a thin grasp of the English language, let alone the Japanese one, has translated it for you completely free of charge.
I think I'll go now.
Go ahead.
I think like similarly, I've been watching or been familiar with the environment of the anime media mix since I think I was middle school. The way I got into it is kind of funny though, because one day I was in a rich cousin's place and he showed me Sword Art Online. And I was hooked. Like, I was like, this is great. And so my introduction to anime has been through the media mix itself, right? Like, it's very much a web novel, like, product, which was animated. And through Sword Art Online, I just didn't get into generally anime manga sphere, but also rest of the media mix. So I checked out the light novel. I checked out the web novel, whatever was translated of that. And through that, like...
You were the perfect consumer.
Yeah. Wow. Like, it is through that where I like found out the whole anime world, right? Like the worlds of anime, manga and stuff like that. So it was through, and I'm still quite like fascinated by a lot of these media mixes, and I engage with almost all the media platforms in which I just say you engage with, right? Like within this specific sphere. So yeah, like, and so that's where my anime manga like interest started. And interestingly enough, that's also where I got into critical theory from. on another clip. Like, because Stru wanted to study more about this very specific media, which I got into discussions about this online, which led me to read more unironically Adorno, like
the original sources.
Yeah, no, also Adorno, like because I got into groups, basically fandom spaces, through which I got more interested into reading theory, which led to most of my current work. So yeah, the media mix is quite huge actually.
I can go next. Part of my role on the episode today is to be sort of an outsider voice. I would imagine I grew up a little bit similar to Morin, although I'm a little bit older. So I was born in 94. When I was a kid, Pokemon was on. I got into Yu-Gi-Oh! And Dragon Ball Z and just the stuff that was on TV and like Toonami and stuff at that time. And then when I was probably like 11, 12, I would get a lot of manga from the local library and got into like, you know, whatever they had, mostly Dragon Ball Z. My interest was like flagging a little bit. And then my cousin, well, shout out Jackson, had like the Shonen Jump magazines. I remember him coming to visit and like showing me his Shonen Jump with all the serial series and like getting really excited about it. And he was into Rave Master, and I got really into the Rave Master manga through him. And anyway, I don't know. My interest sort of flagged in high school, and I just kind of like didn't watch it anymore. It has sort of remained the case since, although Hannah, who is here, often wants to watch anime with me. And so I've watched more with her and sort of have come to like reappreciate the form a bit. More recently, we watched Land of the Lustrous, which I thought was very beautiful. I also really liked the anime Shiki, which she thinks is trash, but I thought it was awesome.
He's great.
And that's about where I stand. I'm sort of anime skeptic, but you know, a friendly skeptic.
I think I've been watching anime very ambiently since I was very young. I spent a lot of my childhood in Korea, and it's kind of just like a lot of regular children's programming there. So some of it was just kind of ambiently getting it from the environment. And I remember the first time that I like kind of, it felt like an intentional first pick, which was at the comic book shop across the corner from my grandparents' apartment. And I went with my brother, who's 3 years older than me at the time, and I picked up a copy of Inuyasha, which was my first like really serious fandom, I would say, that I was in. And I remember two things. It was, the volume was in Korean, and my Korean reading is significantly worse than my English reading. And I remember misreading the character Kikyo, who is a priestess's name, as Cookie, and thinking that Cookie was such a great name for this beautiful female character. And also thinking that Sesshomaru, who's Inuyasha's brother, was a girl. And I thought he was like the most beautiful female character ever. And so I really, really imprinted on him early. And then later, as a teenager, it became kind of like a psychosexual attachment. And I had a lot of printed out photos of Sesshomaru in my room. As a teenager, I was like very much in various fandom spaces and like read a lot of fanfic, wrote a lot of fanfic, was really into fanimes that people would produce online, read a lot of like fan translations on forums of different things. I think notably I was actively consuming the first Danganronpa scans on the Something Awful forums when they were being just screenshotted and then translated as opposed to anything else. And I was a huge fan of those back in the day. But yeah, I think most of my engagement in anime has been through like fandom and online spaces and remixing and this sort of thing.
It's really interesting that without even having to touch upon the book's main concept, it's immediately a media mix. It's an immediately media mix object. I was really into Naruto. And so when it was first airing in the Middle East, that was actually like in the late 2000s. Yeah, late 2000s, early 2010s, which is actually pretty late in comparison to Dragon Ball, which we had earlier. And Digimon we also had earlier. And then I played the games, which spoiled the anime, which actually got me more invested. I was like, no way, Naruto fought Sasuke? That shit is crazy. I was like, these friends broke off. And then I was hooked. Like, the game made me motivated to find out what's going on. And so that's how I got into the great media mix, or the communist media mix, the pirating, you know, the old forums. And they were like Arabic translations and everything. Those are all dead now. But I used to get the Arabic translations, and you had one that were like more poetic. They tried to be like more Arabic poetry prose. And then the others were like just translating using...
That would never happen in English.
Oh yeah. We had like some translations that translate via their local dialect. So you can understand it, but then they have like different variations of the word. Arabic is a very weird language. Like,
That's more interesting than like the English thing, which is like for what, like 20 years or something, the only English translation of JoJo Part 4 was made by like some student from Hong Kong, some like high school student from Hong Kong who barely knew English. It's infamous because there's just random Chinese words in it. It doesn't, you know, it barely makes sense. I read that when I first got into JoJo, that was the only translation in English for Part 4 of the manga. So I had to read that.
I remember those days.
Where the city, which is in Japanese, is called Morio. And in whatever version this student from Hong Kong was reading, it's called Duwang. So everyone called it the Duwang translation. And there's an infamous scene where one of the main villain of the series, Yoshikage Kira, is like having a picnic and he says, "What a beautiful Duwang."
Another early anime experience that I just remembered was me and my brother, who's a little bit younger than me, were at the big like chain bookstore, which had an anime section or a manga section, excuse me. And like we wanted to go look for our Dragon Ball comics, but my dad noticed that we were like being kind of shy or like not going over there. And he's like, "What's wrong?" And so he went and looked, and there were these two like greasy teenage weebs like making out in the manga section. And my dad yelled at them to make them leave. So his little kids could go get their Dragon Ball comics.
That's so cruel.
He destroyed the young love.
He destroyed the young love.
Yeah. I think we're probably ready to move on to the main discussion though.
Yeah.
I think we've covered enough ground.
I do want to say one thing.
Go ahead.
Morin. So one experience of the media mix that I still remember vividly, and I think that's where I got my third world consciousness, is that I was a huge Pokemon fan when I was younger. And there was like these events that were time limited and you had to use the internet. And like Gray, I did not have good internet. Like we had really, really, really shitty internet, maybe until like what? Early 2010s? Then we had like manageable internet.
I think for me it was much later, right? Like it was like 2018 and I had decent internet.
I had the mystery gifts. And so I was huge into the Pokemon games. And then like I was trying to get the Pokemon god Arceus for Pokemon Diamond. Mm. And then you had to go to the Toy...
I know exactly what you're talking about.
I had to go to Toy R Us.
Had to go to GameStop.
I had to go to Toy R Us. So they're like, you had to go to GameStop, which I didn't have. I had a bootleg GameStop that was not licensed in my country. And we knew it was bootleg because they changed their name to be GameSpot, the fucking video game reviewing company. And so they didn't give two fucks. And I'm like, all right, cool. It doesn't matter. And then I'm like, okay, I want to get God, and I want to get God lawfully. You know, I don't want to get my DS ROM hacked to get God. And so I want to get it lawfully because I'm a fan. And so I go to Toys R Us, and then I show them the official Pokemon website, and I show them the announcement. And I'm like, okay, it says that you have internet in Toys R Us, and if I give you my DS with the game cartridge, I can get God. And he's like, no, we can't do that, kid. We don't have that event. And that's when I learned they did not have the third world in mind. And I'm like, damn, God be discriminatory. And I'm like, fuck, I'm not American or European. And then I went back. I did it like a couple of days later. I'm like, all right, it's the announcement says that I should come to you guys. Where's Arceus? And it's like, I'm sorry, kid. Nobody informed us about this. And then I'm like, all right, yeah. Makes sense. I'm not from that world.
I've had so many similar experiences.
All right, well, now, we'll move on to the main discussion. So now we're going to move on to actually talking about Mark Steinberg's book and like some of the big ideas from it, some of the main focuses of the book. The first chapter has a lot of stuff sort of trying to define, like, you know, anime, limited animation as like a medium, as a form, which I think was really useful from a historical perspective. You know, a lot of stuff about like the original creation of the first real anime in the sense that we have it over here, which is to say like the limited animation, usually TV based, often adapted from a manga, which is Astro Boy. And the crazy way that they had to make Astro Boy, where they made it on a loss. They were like losing money making it, and they were like, this is the origin of the anime not having any, you know, the words don't match up with the mouths, because they didn't have the budget to do that. So they would just draw a couple of different lip flaps, you know, put those in there. They already had the script worked out, put those in there roughly enough, and then the voice actors would have to go over the animation and try to dub it. They call it ADR, which stands for like automated dialogue replacement or something, where you have to just dub it live and try to match up with what you're saying with the lip flaps to the best of your ability, which usually there's an illusion that it matches up, but if you pay close attention, it does not match up at all. What do you guys think about this part of the book and this kind of historical reconstruction of like the origins of anime, limited animation?
I liked it. And I think it's one of the strongest parts of the book too, because it also tries to conceptually develop how the media mix can even start from the immobile characters, right? The character design, which has been done, and due to its like limited animation nature, it lends itself easier to be transformed into other forms through the character, other media forms. And I really like how it's historically situated with like debates during those time, and the general ecology of anime production then, right? And the centrality of what Mushi Production was doing for this. And it's just not like budgetary constraints. It was also television time scheduling constraints. So weekly once they had to put out another new episode, which meant they needed to reduce the number of drawings required to produce the whole length of the episode, which basically made it so that they had to cut down on a lot of general Disney style smooth full animation. And so it was also the form of a specific form of capitalism then, like which came into Japan through which proliferated the change in animation too. Which was one of the most interesting parts of the book for me. And this historical, the way he historically develops this in the development of the media mix, through characters moving between worlds, moving between forms.
Let's not get too far ahead of ourselves.
So I really liked it. I think it was great.
Yeah. One thing that stood out to me with regard to the treatment of limited animation is you brought up something I hadn't really thought about. Is like, yeah, they were aware of like the Hanna-Barbera type of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Did Astro Boy come out before or after like Scooby-Doo? I don't know. But when I think of like Western limited animation, it's like the Flintstones, the Jetsons, Scooby-Doo, you know, all the Hanna-Barbera stuff. Like the Flintstones, like their heads move, their bodies stay completely still when they talk. I mean, Family Guy is limited animation. It does the same thing. South Park is limited animation. Almost all of like the weekly, you know, TV shows. The Simpsons is like an exception, or the old Simpsons. That was like hand-drawn cell by cell, I think. But like the modern stuff and the older stuff, you know, like the era of like Flintstones, Jetsons, Yogi Bear, all that shit, all that stuff actually was slop. Like, you can't tell me that fucking Wacky Racers and Flintstones and whatever, it was not slop. I know Flintstones was before Astro Boy. I don't know if Scooby-Doo was, because Scooby-Doo is a little bit more 60s. That stuff was fucking slop though. Like the fucking the Flintstones telling you to smoke cigarettes, like that's crazy.
The famous media mix of the Flintstones vitamins.
Yeah, of course. Yes. Flintstones vitamins, Flintstones gummies. Yeah. So, no, Scooby-Doo gummies.
The various Disney propagandas and the creation of Disney World. Technically, on the case of the book, it wouldn't be a media mix, but it would be like a media mix strategy of advertisement and franchising.
Yeah. It seems like there's... We're kind of pushing towards getting to the media mix stuff, which is kind of the meat of the book. But I'd just like to remark on two more things about the history of the limited animation really quick, which is like the first thing is like two of these terms that they used when like Astro Boy first came out is they referred to it on one hand as TV manga and the other hand as electric kamishibai. And kamishibai is some old school like Japanese... like street entertainment thing where they would basically do, you know, they would have like a painting and they would have these like little characters or scenes on like a stick and they would narrate it. So they're like, oh, I'm going to, you know, it was like a puppet show, but with like paper cutouts instead of puppets, essentially. And they would just have people who rode around on bikes with like a big bag full of these drawings to go present all of the, you know, the latest, this was also like a weekly or like daily, even like serial format. And so when anime first came out, Astro Boy first came out, people were like, what is this shit? Just a electric kamishibai. I thought that was kind of an interesting historical detail that I definitely had never heard of before.
Yeah, I liked the chapter one. I think for me, it's because I read Thomas Lamar's, which is the author is a heavy inspiration for this book. He's in the acknowledgments and he's cited frequently, and he's like a giant in this like anime manga studies. I think one thing I kind of wished that this book tackled, which I think it's like reading this, or at least rereading this now in chapter one with you all, I found that there's like a real, there's like no account of animation as labor. Like there's no account of the animator as laborer. So it's like a very, like it's a, in my, now I notice, I'm like, oh, it's a bit too aerial of a view of like a, mm-hmm. of a history. And I'm like, okay, obviously animation in the past was like this layer by layer. And that's how we get the limited animation thing, because doing it, you have to have the background and then you have like a different foregrounds and then you have the character and you have to have different colors and you have to move the thing and then you animate. And you had to do this in like a very limited sense. And so both Steinberg and Lamar in his book, The Anime Machine, kind of theorized this. I think what I was thinking about now is kind of to think about the labor component of all of this, where I'm like, okay, what does it mean? What was the labor composition back in the day? You know, what was the, who are these laborers? How were they educated? How were they, like, how were they socially reproduced and what are they producing? That's something I was kind of missing here. And it's something that I, something that I was like, it hit me because later on, and I think we'll get to it, they mentioned like a big production shift from the Tatsumu Astro Boy model of like, we are producing like limited animation in a very quick turnaround. And we're doing this in like, at the beginning, it was like a material constraints of scheduling, labor, et cetera. Uh-huh. And then it kind of, this form itself then became autonomous, right? It became autonomous. And then we had this whole ecology. And I was like, okay, this changes to like a committee model there in the future. But you can see the germ there in the beginning. And I was like, okay, what's the labor story of this? And that's something I wish we had, if that makes sense.
The committee thing specifically seems more on the management side.
Yeah. And to me, whenever I hear management, I think labor, if that makes sense. I'm like, okay, you give me the management side. My Marxist brain goes, there's a labor story. There was class struggle there. And I'm like, okay, what happened? So
There's just barely a hint of it when Steinberg mentions what animators in Japan apparently call Tezuka's curse, referencing Osamu Tezuka, the creator of Astro Boy, which is like the incredibly low budgets and, you know, tight schedules that anime production run on is like, that's Tezuka's curse.
Yeah. I kind of wish that was put in the theoretical architecture of this book, because this book is very, very theoretical, as well as like historically incisive. Like there's a lot of citations and they pay a lot of close attention to both media theorists and workers in Japan and then the anime manga, the Anglophone American speaking world. And I'm like, all right, this is great. And I was like, okay, where is the animator? You know, because it's something that we still, and this is me reading it in the present, if that makes sense. But yeah. I don't want to hamper.
So let's kind of move on to talking about the meat of the book, as I called it a bit earlier, which is the media mix stuff. I'm interested in hearing, Cam, what did you think about this stuff as the outsider's voice, as you designated yourself at the start?
Yeah, I don't know. I think was left like still not completely sure how specific the story is to anime as a form. I was just thinking, talking about the Flintstones vitamins, also of like being a little kid and being at the grocery store with my mom and like really, really wanting her to get SpongeBob shaped macaroni, and she wouldn't get it because she thought it was like it cost more because it's branded. But I wanted to consume the totality of the SpongeBob media mix. You know, I want to live SpongeBob. I don't want to just watch it, the story. But yeah, I don't know. Like, anime feels like a specific thing to me, but I wasn't sure if the media mix aspect was original to anime, or is the defining feature that distinguishes it?
I think Mark Steinberg's argument is trying to say that the roots of SpongeBob media mix is also in Otomo, like Astro Boy. And I think some points he tries to make this argument that the germs of media mixes around the world starts from Japan, or Japan is the most representative of it too. I don't think he makes a firm claim either way, but I think he hints towards that, right?
Yeah, I think that's his thinking. So in like chapter 4, where he defines the media mix, in many of the footnotes, he made sure to give different criteria on how it differs from like the American, what was it called, cross media advertisement, and stuff of that ilk. And so they were like, okay, the media mix appeared historically as a term in the 1970s, endogenously from the industry, but the practices, as the book gives us the story of Astro Boy and the various toys and stickers and merchandising that Astro Boy lived, and then how the market more or less constructed the child as a consumer, from which later on, via them growing up and the commodity infrastructure getting more complex, gets reintegrated again in the big conglomerate Kadokawa books. So the media mix, I think, according to Steinberg, would be something similar to the American cross-media advertisement, but would be different than it because, A, it happened first historically, and then his, I think, argument would be the development of the media mix was happening as like a negotiation between the Japanese advertisers and management studies and people like that, reading Americans, kind of mixing and matching it, and then they were, I think the main thing that they have difference is that they don't really care about the product itself. They want to sell you the ecosystem. And I think that's the main, that's the conceptual innovation that he's trying to say this exists.
Related to this, Steinberg distinguishes between what he calls the marketing media mix and the anime media mix. So like the former, the marketing media mix is like, you know, it's like what Star Wars does, where Star Wars had toys, they had novelizations. That was a big thing back in like the 70s and 80s, novelizations of movies. They don't do it anymore because no one reads. All that kinds of stuff. They had, you know, that kind of shit. And they had advertisements on television, advertisements in magazines, advertisements, obviously, you know, trailers at the movie theater. That was like the marketing media mix. And then they have the anime media mix, which is like all this stuff, you know, a lot of stuff targeted towards kids, like the candy, the toys. Obviously, you have like the manga and the anime as like the main sort of components, I guess, or like the source material somewhere between those two. But also like beyond the actual content, like the narrative content, the specific characters from the anime and the manga, and the world, the overall world from these. So like he has this kind of, I expressed some doubts when we were reading this book, because I was like, chapters 2 and 3, this book is a great book, but the chapters 2 and 3 can be a little bit of a beat down because it is 100 pages about candy and toys. Nonstop. It's about eating candy, chocolate, the history of chocolates and toys in Japan. And, you know, it's very enlightening, but like, it's sort of incredible how much material Steinberg can pull out about candy and toys, I will say. But like the main stuff of like the Astro Boy, the original Astro Boy media mix that he draws attention to is this candy. I don't remember the name of it. It was like marble chocolates was what was the name of the candy, which was just like a ripoff of M&M's that came in a tube. And they started including a sticker of Astro Boy in the candy. And this made it like the most popular candy in Japan by like a mile. It was like an insane, you know, phenomenon.
One thing that I think is interesting or worth saying in terms of how specific this argument is to anime versus other things generally is that I think there's like probably two levels of argument that you can make here. One of them, I think, Antara, you kind of had mentioned, which is that it could just be about the specificity or like the that Japan did it first in the context of anime as a marketing strategy. But also, I think in terms of the general type of argument that he's making in terms of like what the commodity was, I think it's a general Fordist to post-Fordist argument. And in that way, I feel like it's not specific to anime. And I think that one of the things that I found kind of dissatisfying about this book and the account is that these are kind of fuzzy with each other and they're not very clearly delineated out. Like if it's just a historical argument about something that happened within the Japanese ecosystem first, media ecosystem first, I think that is fine. But he seems like he's trying to make a more broad argument about kind of like history.
I think he wants to say that there's continuity between limited animation and the medium mix. In a way that there is no continuity in other medium mixes, right? At least in Astro Boy's case, that there is a general movement from how the animation functions, the form and content of the animation, to stickers and toys. And that's specific to Japan.
Yeah, there's definitely some like formal overlap with like the very, you know, the static dynamic image of the character or whatever he calls it. But then also like there's a very like real reason that Astro Boy in particular had to resort to this is because, as Steinberg says, the animation itself was literally just unprofitable. They were losing money.
Yep.
So they needed, the only way for them to recoup on investment, the only way for the company, Tezuka's company, to actually make money was to leverage the merchandising rights and whatnot. And that sort of gives birth to the media mix.
Yeah, I actually fully agree with Hana, where weirdly enough, I don't think there's a strong mediational account of the two levels in the Steinberg book, because in one of the examples, I forgot if it's in chapter 5 or chapter 4, he goes, the germs, the media mix has multiple developments. There was the Astro Boy, and then the next touchstone would be the 2000 with the 2000s with the popular like property Haruhi Suzumiya, and then would be the almost, he doesn't call it vertical integration, but might as well just call it vertical integration. The vertical integration of the various big companies, and the touchstones there is Kadokawa, I think. And then he goes back in time, and then he goes like the Astro Boy to show you that this change was already like the change in the media mix, where the narrative itself can be, he uses Leibniz, like the compossibility of the understanding of the world. Whereas like Astro Boy, the anime, in one of the episodes, and it was aired in like 1966, goes to space and dies. But the manga, Astro Boy lives. And then both of these stories exist all at once and with the same advertisement ecosystem. Then there was like another anime where the Astro Boy that died got reincarnated somehow and then aired few years later. And it's like, this is the true power of the anime media mix, where the nexus of all of this advertisements, world, whatever, would be this character, the character image, what he calls. Yeah. I don't find that satisfying precisely because there's no labor account. You can't go through the Fordist and post-Fordist account without saying, okay, what was the animators doing, you know? because the to make the commodity would be living labor, right? So it has to be the creative act of living labor and social organization and stuff like this. So I think that's the main mediation, you know, the root, the ground, the metabolic interaction, I think, is just obfuscated. And I think that's the main issue there, is that the main mediation is not there.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I think the only time that Steinberg really brings up labor is to say, like, to appeal to some European, you know, fadi-dadi who's like, under le neo-capitalism post-modern, consumption is itself an act of labor.
Well, you're doing a French voice, okay. But he's specifically talking about Italians, I think. Like, he talks about the autonomous Marxist at one point.
There was
point.
Also a French guy in there, I swear. I'm pretty sure there was a French guy in there,
too. I was curious about... I was mostly caught by the reference to the Italian autonomist, which he, like, only kind of hand-wavingly references. But, like, there is this, like, really big problem, I think, of, like, this... social factory concept about, you know, consumption as production, and this is like a new mode of accumulation or whatever, which he at one point just comes out and says, like, there has been a fundamental change in capitalism, and is kind of implying that this new mode that's so consumer oriented, which I think is very dubious, and like is a big problem that I like to think about in terms of like post-war Marxist theory.
Yeah, I think one aspect, I think, how do I say this? One aspect that he mentions in the book, which I found funny. So in one of the big conglomerates, Kadokawa, the father created this company in the early 20th century, after, I think, the Pacific War, and he created this company.
Which they refer to World War II as the Pacific War in this book by an American author kind of caught me off guard. Like, is that what they call it in Japan?
I don't know. But that's what they said. And then the company was supposed to be this highbrow literary company to kind of lift up Japanese culture, whatever. And then he dies, and then his son takes over, and his son is like, he's such a character. He's you know how there's like capital as a like a personification mask? Like, he was born with the mask, you know? It's just like, he was born with the mask. And I quote, and this is on page 159. And so this is his media mix strategy of trying to make sure that you enter this anime system ecology at any point, and then they will sell merchandise and advertisement for you. And so he goes, be it books or music or films, they are commodities without substance. They are not material commodities like electrical appliances or cars. Books and records and films can all be said to be fantasies that become commodities. If these fantasies did not have commodity value, books, for example, would become merely paper and ink. The business of selling these kind of fantasies or illusions is very suited to an active nihilist like myself. You know? and then he writes a biography, by the way, which he calls, in Japanese, My Struggle, referencing Kettler, you know. And then he gets caught by, like, what, cocaine dealing, and then his brother takes the fucking it's fucking crazy. Reading this, and I'm like, that's crazy.
Man. There's like this behind the scenes struggle between the brother that Anatar was just talking about is named Haruki Kadokawa, and his brother Tsukuhiko. Where Haruki is like obsessed with like making gigantic blockbusters and making money doing the media mix by like, oh, you know, all the different advertising and then doing novelization and all of that crap and like, you know, selling the soundtrack and all of that stuff. And Sugihiko is like more in tune with like anime and stuff. So he's like, you know, trying to make these magazines that are specifically targeted to like smaller consumer bases. They use like consumer segmentation or audience segmentation is like a term Steinberg uses, I think.
Yeah.
And doing this more, you know, micrological, I guess you could maybe call it, divide and conquer sort of strategy, as opposed to just trying to do these gigantic blockbusters. And like, Sugihiko leaves Kadokawa to form his own company, but then Haruki gets arrested for sniffing coke. So he comes back and becomes the CEO because he's still part of the family. And he remained the CEO until, like, I looked up his Wikipedia page, where I looked up the Wikipedia for Kadokawa. He was the CEO until, like, 2019 when he got caught committing crimes because he was trying to bribe the Olympic Committee to be one of the main sponsors of the Tokyo Olympics. And he had to resign in, like, 2019. So, you know, none of these guys they can't help themselves.
This is where you go absolute cinema. this is capitalism, baby.
And, you know, he must have been like 70, 80 years old or something at that time. I couldn't find his birth date, but he was pretty old.
To return to the quote that Annotara mentioned, I mean, like, it's just, again, to me, this is like, it maps very cleanly onto what he's describing as like a Fordist and post-Fordist mode of accumulation. But like, there is just a very basic Capital Volume 1 story of like, you know, there was a time when there was a proliferation of producing appliances and durable commodities like this, and then there was a decline in the rate of profit and capital had to expand, and there was a growth in like the entertainment and like service sector, which is very much a story in like the advanced economies of the West as well. It just seemed like to me a very general post-war story, which I think is a very important story and an important one to theorize, and one that has a lot of like, it tends to trip up a lot of Marxists. But yeah, I that was the only, like, basically the only part of the book I was particularly interested in was like this Fordist post-Fordist thing, and then I don't think he did it complete justice.
Yeah, I definitely see what you mean. Like the advantage of this kind of production, what they're apparently in Japan call contents industry, which is like, you know, they were ahead of the curve too with referring to everything as content
apparently.
Yeah. But like everything like music, movies, like television, all of this stuff is just lumped in as contents for like accounting purposes or something in Japan. I don't know. Is that the distribution of like monopoly rights, which is like what this whole stuff about like characters and worlds is about, right? Is intellectual property is the right, is having the monopoly over production of certain commodities, which is the music, the movies, the manga, the novels, the toys, etc. Right? It's the distribution of this monopoly right to produce this. And monopoly is just the right to tell everyone else that you can't produce this, right? In the context of like intellectual property. And that obviously has an advantage over like production of things like appliances or cars, because, you know, past a certain point they're somewhat interchangeable. Whereas this is not as true, or, you know, part of the trick of this is convincing people that it's not true of media commodities. These are not interchangeable, while at the same time they're being, you know, homogenized and turned into slop.
Well, I think that
turned into content.
I think there's a kind of interesting to the thing about having a monopoly over some sort of intellectual property. I do feel like there's kind of a symbiotic relationship between some of these media companies and fan communities in particular, because, you know, at anime cons and like various other places where a lot of fans proliferate, people will like create art of these characters and just sell them. And technically you're not really supposed to do that. Like, a company could come in and be like, this is our intellectual property and you can't do that without giving us a cut. But I do feel like in the past 20 years, there's been kind of this recognition that fan communities and having other people produce art of this intellectual property is the thing that helps bolster or proliferate more fandom. And so in some ways, not having a monopoly over that is the thing that seems kind of like beneficial.
Steinberg draws attention to like the law around like what is a character and how intellectual property law relates to this stuff is really like hazy, which I think is important. But I think there are also, like you pointed out, Hannah, there are very, very real economic reasons for them to do this as well, that I think people have discovered first in Japan and then a little bit later over here. in the land of the setting sun, that they do have, there are economic incentives to being a little bit lax with the intellectual property law when it comes to the fans.
I do wonder why you can find a similar, almost developmental pattern with this stuff. So I know, for example, PC games back in the day, developers really fostered modding communities to kind of bolster their game. And that's how we got, for example, Counter-Strike, which was like a mod of like Half-Life. So I do wonder, I guess there is a fear that I think, you know, like, I guess there's a mediation there. You know, where's the, like, he found a legal law there, and then there's, like, the actual subjectivities. I'm like, where's the mediation, my guy? Like,
video game mods are kind of an interesting case because those are considered to, like, be your own intellectual property. Like, Counter-Strike, Valve had to buy Counter-Strike, and they also had to buy Dota from the creator of that, which was also a mod. It was a mod for Warcraft 3. Which is would not be the case with, like, you know, an anime fan magazine or something.
Like a cam, I think.
Or to a certain extent.
I think like, concur with Hannah's opinion, right? I think the difference here is specifically that, especially when you're talking about consumerist producer, at least in the anime manga ecosphere, they actually were, especially in stuff like Comic-Cons, Comic-Cons, it was a big thing to sell fan works of a lot of media works, which proliferated, which like basically led to the further spread of the media tool. So at least in that specific anime manga context, fan works were central to its like culture. And it still is to a large extent. And it's one of the central appeals of that too. So Steinberg's argument overall, I don't think works. Like consumers are not directly producers. But within the actual production and selling of fan works, I think it holds, right?
Yeah, and I think there is a very interesting like line here too. The intensity of anime fandom, like the otaku and weeb culture and like fan culture is a very intense kind of subjectivity that is only kind of only starts to emerge in this account. But I think is one of the most interesting things, like why having a podcast on the anime question is funny and like interesting. Anime is such like a charged cultural object.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sexually charged.
Yeah, charged in basically every direction that you could imagine.
Yeah. If we do a follow-up to this, which I think we probably will at some point, I definitely want to talk about Tamaki Saito's book.
We should really talk about
Fighting
it.
Girl. Which gets into a little bit more of that kind of dimension.
So the first of many studies to come from the anime subcommittee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. One part of this, part of Steinberg's book, which we kind of didn't, we can just kind of freewheel it from here on out, I think. We got a little bit more time, but we're getting towards the end of the podcast here, I think. Is the centrality of characters in anime, which connects to the media mix and the world in anime. So I'm gonna read a quotation here. This is from the last chapter of the book, is on page 200 of the book here. Steinberg is listing out he says this is about the character, or like anime as like a character system and the media mix in connection to like characters in the world. He says, we should say that the anime media mix simultaneously creates one, the character merchandise as material object. Two, the world to which the character merchandise belongs. And three, the character as immaterial connective agent guaranteeing the consistency of this ever-expanding world. Insofar as the narrative or product series continues, this world can never be apprehended in toto, but only approached through the continuous participatory consumption of the character and its world. And he uses, kind of as an example of this, he talks about a manga called MPD Psycho by the writer of it is Eiji Otsuka, who's like a sort of a famous, I don't know, a known like literary critic
and like author,
like a literary critic and an author of various things in Japan. But I would say something that's kind of similar to this, very similar to this prototype is like, he also mentions The Matrix as like a prime Western example of this. Like Matrix had the main movies, but then there was also a comic. They had multiple video games. They had an animated movie, Animatrix, which had all different backstories. You had to watch all this shit to understand it. But one thing that is very similar to this kind of description is Warhammer by Games Workshop. Because the core of Warhammer is literally selling toys. It is selling toys that people have to paint. But Warhammer is like so, like they, it's like an enormous, like Games Workshop, which is the company that produces Warhammer, is like, I don't know if they're one of the biggest companies in the UK, but they're like up there, right? And this is all they do, is literally they make toys and they, you know, leverage in various ways the merchandising rights for the world that is built around these toys. So they make video games, novels, they have a whole publishing wing. They have, I don't know if they've done a movie. They might have at some point, like a small one. There's even, you know, there's obviously tons of fan stuff. There's a death metal band, Bolt Thrower, famous death metal band that makes Warhammer themed music. And it's kind of crazy because it kind of seems like they kind of developed it more or less in parallel with the anime stuff over the course of like the 80s and 90s.
Similarly in Japan, and I was quite surprised Steinberg doesn't talk about this, is the Toho project, which is primarily based on characters, right? Toho project is a set of shoot 'em ups. It's a video game with great music. It's a bullet hell game, right? Like, it's a bullet hell, you need to avoid tiny bullets in the screen. And Toho's characters are one of the, it's one of the main things which gets reproduced in fanworks. And it's just not the characters, it's the music. So you have Toho music, Toho characters, Toho different games produced by different people, which all is in the same ecology of production. It's like niche production by like what's generally known as doujin groups. Why I found this interesting was like, I think Steinberg focuses a lot on the company form, the conglomerate form with post for this production, and I think various types of development of business that way. But this also is mirrored in indie production. Indie production, and with Toho, this becomes really big, right? And I found that interesting that there's like, I didn't find a mention of that in the book. Either it's mimetic to the normal, Toho is mimetic to the normal company production, or like they follow the similar logic. While not being big capital the way he frames it.
Yeah. Fair enough. I think there is this, like, with something like Toho, it's the same kind of, like, this is not a particularly kind way to designate it, but it's this sort of petty bourgeois utopianism, which reminds me of, like, Linux or, you know, open source software and shit like that.
Oh, yeah. Like,
yeah.
And that's another account which is missing here, is the petty bourgeois forms through which the media mix functions, which is not centralized.
Mm.
by a company.
I agree. I think it's a, No, I agree. I think it's like a really, I mean, I think kind of like reflecting or repeating some of the other things that have been said, like, I do think that anime, like, there is kind of a question of like, what is the utility of thinking specifically about anime as an object as opposed to any other kind of media? And I think that, you know, obviously they're like all media has its own kind of ecosystem that it develops in, but I think that the thing that kind of does make anime very interesting is that it does have this like kind of fandom associated with it that is very decentralized, and I think does inform like the way that it does get created by the corporation, but also, you know, it like in some ways, like I think that many of the arguments that are being made in the book, like about the Fordist and post-Fordist stuff, the stuff about character, like I think these are certainly true about anime, but I found myself wondering throughout if it is like uniquely true about anime, particular with the character stuff as well, because I think that there is a lot of different types of media that are focused on character. And I think, you know, there could be an argument that like maybe it was very early or something like this, but to me it does seem difficult in some ways to imagine some sort of licensing that isn't specific to character, given that character is one of the easiest things to visually represent. Yeah. Like it's very difficult to visually represent a world, but it's very simple to visually represent a mascot. And like in so far as that there's something specific or interesting about anime, I think something like mascot is kind of unique, at least in like a lot of East Asian contexts. There's like all these random mascots, like there's like a mascot of you know, the police officers, there's like train mascots, there's like literally anything that you could think of, you'll see a really cute mascot for it. And I do think it's like kind of a puzzling thing that there's so much focus on creating mascots for various things, which I do think is very character centric as well, but seems a little bit more idiosyncratic. But I don't know the history of these sort of things.
Actually
with this, I think this leads into the question of subsumption he was talking about, right? Like and I think he tries to also develop a relationship between the worlds and subsumption in his descriptions of it, like how in everything being commodified and in stuff which was previously uncommodifiable or like the market couldn't reach becomes reachable through characters, which leads to worlds, which leads gives access to different worlds, the way he puts it, I think was interesting. So this is where I wanted to ask, right? Like, were you guys sold on his account of subsumption, which he does borrow from like the Italians, largely Negri and stuff? Because I agree with Anathara when you talked about there's no labor mediation here. Because for Marx, subsumption is specifically to do with the labor process. But while Steinberg hints towards that, he doesn't really talk about it apart from the consumers as producers thing.
Yeah, I'm not very convinced by the real subsumption stuff. Like, red alarms started going off when he cited Brian Masumi for the definition of real subsumption. For those not, Brian Masumi is like a commentator on Deleuze and Guattari. He's a anti-Marxist commentator on Deleuze and Guattari, I would characterize him as. I mean, explicitly, he's like, historical materialism is not, he's like, Marxism is dead. Like, he's explicitly said stuff like this in various writings he's made. So it just seems like that, if that's your authority, like, you know, this is not the good authority. I can kind of like, and sometimes he'll quote from these people without explicitly like approving of what they're saying. Like the one French guy who's like, oh, they do not even sell commodities anymore. Now they sell a fantasy of a world and whatever the fuck, you know, like, I don't even know if Steinberg is explicitly like endorsing this stuff, but he's just kind of trying to, at some point it felt to me like he's just trying to point at this objective transformation and, you know, sort of give all these different viewpoints on all these different theoretical viewpoints that have been elaborated on what the transformation actually amount to. What is the essential, you know, thing about it?
Yeah.
No, cool. But I felt that there was a little bit too much of doing that and not enough of, I don't know, synthetic or like just taking a strong sort of position and specifying it at points, at least.
I think there is subsumption going on here, like in a very specific form. I just don't think Steinberg is describing the subsumption process. I think he's describing something different.
Yeah, I think that's my thing. I don't think it's a subsumption process. In a sense, if you like, he, and I think this is goes to Morin's point. So the book in the intro says like it's taking from various disciplines, anthropology, science and technology studies, et cetera, et cetera. It's taking, it's quite eclectic. But then it Steinberg says that it would be a system theoretic account. And I think what I was thinking through, I was like, okay, if it's like a system theoretic account, there will be a lot of network talk. And it's like implicit in a lot of the book. So it's like ecosystem, anime system, the character as a nexus of worlds and narratives, right? And it's the main thing that differs from the character and a brand, say, and it's because the character is like has more narrativization. It's like if a brand would be, in his word, would be like lifestyle, and character world would be like narrative worlds. And from our McIntyre, we love our narratives. And I think it would be much stronger if he attended to the, and I think it just comes from the labor process. It's just like in the 60s and 70s was also like this information revolution. He mentions that it's like an information thing, but then we can just say like this, like that our network ontology and computer science say directed acyclic graphs, that was just a systemized thing that we already done, you know, and he already does that in Astro Boy. So it's less real subsumption and more making capitalist domination from implicit to explicit, you know, more systemized, more developed. And that has all sorts of both things that we can use, you know, these technologies have multiple things that we can use, but it's also like they developed under this ecology. And I think that's my thing, because I was like, okay, they're now these conglomerates works at platforms. These, like, I'm scared that he would think the view of like, oh, these platforms democratize, you know, media consumption, because then you can put the committee produced anime, and then if somehow we get like a Kickstarter or whatever, and they can also put it in the platform, you know, because now it's not like a broadcast, it's not like a TV television set. So I think that's my thing. I don't think it's a subsumption.
Actually, he does not. I think his next book, Platform Capitalism, which I think is just as wild as this one, he directly takes it into a quite Foucauldian turn, right? Where he does talk about managerial logics and power in that way, but still doesn't get to the question of mediation. And specifically starts to talk about how like platform economy moves to platform society, and how everything becomes integrated, subsumed in the way he's talking here into platform society. So he doesn't say it gets... he doesn't say it gets democratic. He says it gets less democratic, more surveillance, more control, more... but again, from the point of view of largely how consumption functions without any account of labor in that sense. It's still a good book, though.
Agreed.
Yeah, I mean, I also, as I mentioned, found the account, especially around this real subsumption and especially the use of the Italian autonomous, as I mentioned, dubious. And like, it's not even that I think like this kind of extension of the concept of real subsumption is illegitimate. Like it's something that I'm interested in, although still thinking about quite a bit. And as I mentioned also, like I do think that the production of consumer subjectivity is like a big question of the 20th century and one that is a stumbling block for Marxists and also fodder for some kind of vague postmodern theory, which I think this is kind of lapsing into a little bit. Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, yeah, like even the reference to Deleuze's postscript on society's control is like something that I find as a bit of a red flag. Like, it's not a piece that I love from Deleuze, and I think it is kind of abused a little bit to make this kind of whatever, this new mode of accumulation type thing that is a little too like kind of dizzy and taking too much things on their own terms. And like, I don't know, I think it's a big question, like this consumer economy and culture industry stuff is, there is something very specific about it, but I was not satisfied with the way it was being done here.
And I guess on that note, we're going to wrap up. Yeah, I think overall, we definitely recommend this book. It's not too long. It's about 200 pages, although it is rather dense, you know. It's definitely a great read if you're interested in anime, if you're a fan of it at all. And even if you're not, I think it has, if you're interested in toys, candy, that, you know, having fun, playing, you know, it is the season to be interested in toys and candy.
I was sold on the toys and candies.
Tis the season and all that.
It makes you want to go buy the toys. Like, it was like, hell yeah.
Yeah, I think my main takeaway from the book is Ray and I need to get some Astro Boy stickers and start putting them on everything.
Indeed.
And just kind of live in the Astro Boy world.
Yeah, 100%. I'm going to go watch Astro Boy now. Like, and get the stickers. And hopefully the toys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And get some chocolates too, hopefully.
Yeah, yeah.
Get some like chocolates from the 60s on eBay.
This episode should be coming out probably a little bit before New Year, but I'd like to take this opportunity to wish all of our listeners a happy new year. Yeah. Or maybe an unhappy new year. Maybe we'll post the Gramsci thing about how he hates the new year, like we always do. but with that, we're signing off.
See y'all.
Bye-bye.
And I'll say Merry Christmas. Because we're allowed to say it.
Hey. That is strictly forbidden here.
Is it also forbidden in the Japanese context? Apparently they eat a lot of chicken.
Yeah, they eat KFC. Everyone knows this. This is like, oh, you know, Japanese people eat fucking KFC at chicken because they got tricked by an ad in the 80s and now they, you know, whatever.
I actually didn't know that.
Happy KFC Christmas, guys.
Yes.
Yeah, I'll allow that. I'll allow the promotion of capitalism. I won't allow the promotion of Christianity. We're strictly against that. We're keeping the Christ out of Christmas over here. All right, but we will. You'll hear from us again in 2 weeks. Until then, signing off for real this time.
Bye bye. これかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこれかこ